I think we'll start with the diagram tonight. We've had a few before, we'll have another one. Down here, I'm going to put a square to represent the mineral world. In the next level, a pair of leaves will do to represent the plant world. In the next level, an animal. In the next level, a man. And this man has a five-pointed star in his head, so he represents the man dictated to by his five senses. And above this level, there's another man, whose head is a bit bigger probably, and he has a double triangle or six-pointed star. And we're going to talk about levels of being. We know that if we represent the origin of all things as cause, cause equals power. Somewhere up here, there is power absolute. And this power, by a process of self-involvement, generates all the levels below. Now we tend, in the time process, to start with the material world, the mineral world. When we do so, we are dealing with something that up here is quite free, and down here is bound. Suppose we represent a circle in here for bondage, another one here, another, another, and we'll have another on the top, and then a couple of free horns. Remember that the semicircle is to remind us that force descends through successive levels down to a limiting factor and then climbs up again. So we have a force from the absolute, from the infinite, involving itself in successive layers of being, or successive vehicles, successive coverings. Let's start with the lowest one of all, the closed one of matter as the mineral world. This one is inertic. It is the only world we know of that acts only when it's struck from outside. If we take a billiard ball, it will lie indefinitely on the billiard table until we take the cue and hit the ball with the cue. So we can say that the billiard ball is the type of entity response of the mineral world. It does not move unless it is struck from outside. Now, immediately above this level, we have the level of the plant, and we see something in the plant that we do not see in the mineral world. We see orientation. The plant stays where it is, but nevertheless, its roots seek moisture, and its branches seek light. So there is a tendency in the plant to break out of its own center. If we take a round thing like a billiard ball, it remains itself. If we take a round thing like the seed of a plant, as soon as it gets moisture and warmth, it starts to grow from inside. So in the plant, there's a principle that orientates itself. But it doesn't uproot itself and run about. When we come to the animal, we find a level that runs about. So that if we let the mineral world be represented by pure inertia that does not change unless acted upon from outside, we can say that the plant world represents the feeling level of being, where there is a definite orientation without pursuit. There is a preparedness and readiness to grow, providing the means of life come to it, moisture and heat. In the animal level, there is not only a preparedness to go, to grow, there is actually a running about in pursuit of the means of growth. The animal runs about to find its food. When we climb up to the level of the empirical man, we find that the means of life are pursued by the man, like the animal pursues them, but he adds to it a process of comparing the sense data from his five sense organs and computing with these the best means of surviving. He does something that the animal doesn't do adequately. He compares things from different sources. He goes all over the world for his information, and he brings all the sources of information together in a manner that the animal cannot do. The animal can do it to a very, very limited degree. We find in the anthropoid apes a tendency to use a stick as a lever, or to knock off a banana or something, or to pile boxes on each other. But we do not find them collating these things and making very wide analogies between different levels of being. But in the empirical man, we do. Now, when we come to the man above the empirical, the man with the double triangles, we're concerned with a man who thinks not after the fact from experience, but before the fact from first geometrical principles. To think geometrically is to say that if a certain thing occurs, something else necessarily follows. Now, in the realm of the empirical man, there is no necessity. There is only statistical probability. Science, built by empirical men using their five senses, does not admit necessity at all. It only admits statistical probability. If you go to the USA, into New York, a sufficient number of times in the year and find a lot of automobiles there, you'll be led to expect some more if you go again. But there's nothing necessary about that, because the next war might wipe them all out. Might submerge Manhattan Island itself. So, for the empirical five-sense scientist, there is no necessity. There is only statistical probability. But for the man of the double triangle, the man of the a priori knowledge, there is necessity. And he thinks in terms of necessary behaviors, of necessary behaviors of energies. The logic of the dialectic of the double triangle says that if we close the zone by running a force round it, we wall it off, that we have necessarily isolated the inside from the outside. That the circle necessarily includes and excludes simultaneously. Now this is a self-evident thing as soon as we state it. But it is not self-evident to the man who depends on his five sense organs all the time. As a matter of fact, most empirical scientists would even doubt the necessity of a circle enclosing a zone at all. They would say that it might be merely some phenomenal behavior of the sensory part of our organism. And therefore, the empirical man cannot see the necessity in this. But there is something in a human being that can see the necessity of such facts. And this something in the human being is the level of the necessary logical relations. Now, I've drawn this graph because it would be a very good idea if we make such a graph for ourselves. If each one of us actually makes such a graph, and then on this graph places his knowledge about any given subject. Now, at the top level, we have the absolutely free spirit. This means that in any subject where you are fully spiritually enlightened, you are free. And as soon as we come down to the level of the logical, we see that we are conditioned in some measure. When we come down to the necessary logic and the double triangle, we are immediately deprived of the purely free, and we gain free dome. We have now domed free, we have wrapped it up in the first phase, and we have enclosed our concept, we have formulated the free spirit. And in the act of formulation, that which was free becomes bound. Now this double triangle, the six-pointed star, is the symbol of macrocosmic wisdom. It is the wisdom of necessary closures, of necessary relations. Nevertheless, it is a limitation. So no matter how big we make the circle of the macrocosmos, it is still a limitation. If we take the Gospel of John and consider the Logos in the first verse, we find that the word, the Logos, is stated to be in the beginning with God and to be a God. Nevertheless, that Logos is not that which is beyond it. That which is beyond it is the absolute. That absolute is absolutely free, and being absolutely free has of itself nothing existent, but everything is beyond existence within it. Its first determination is therefore its first bondage. The man bound by necessary logic, determined by it, is at the top level. If he lets go of his necessary logic, he then commits himself to the experiential logic of the five-pointed star. When he does this, he now becomes dependent not on a logical process of either or, and the identity of either and or, the identity of opposites, but he comes into a state of dependence on five very, very limited sense organs. If you consider the whole mass of your body, and a very small amount of the cells of the body used up in special sense organs like the eyes, the ears, the nose, and so on, you find the greatest mass of your body is not illuminated directly by sense organ activity. The general diffusion of the sense of touch over the body is the widest spread. The sense of touch is spread over your body pretty widely, but there are points of anesthesia throughout the body. It is not total. If you look at the sense of smell, it's fairly vague, and you can get a sensation of perfumes coming in your nostrils from over the hills and far away. But you can't tell whether the chip shop is round the corner to the right or the left, because it depends on the direction of the air current, where it comes to you from. So that if the wind happens to spin vertically, then you can get false orientation about the location of the chip shop. You may notice that if a fly comes in a room in search of something, perhaps it's something sweet, the fly will not fly straight to it, but it will fly in certain apparently haphazard directions. It is really flying upon gradients of increasingly strong smell, determined by the air currents in the room, so that the empirical man is like this fly. He can only fly in the direction of the sense stimulus. And as the sense stimuli are very, very particularized on the five points of the sense organs, the man who gets information only from the sense organs is automatically deprived of a terrific number of sources of information. Between the five points of the triangle that represent the five sense organs, we have great spaces where no information is available at all between the five sense organs. The eye responds to a certain limited number of frequencies, the ear to another number of frequencies. Between the visual frequencies and the audio frequencies, there is a terrific gap. Scientifically, we know that this gap is filled with motion, with frequencies, but the sense organs can tell you nothing whatever about them. But although the specialized sense organs can't tell you anything about them, nevertheless, the substance of your body can. Wherever the sense organ is not specialized, wherever the nervous system itself does not insert a limiting factor, a control factor on the cell, then you have the cell responding totally and therefore filling in the frequency gaps that exist between the five sense organs. This means to say that if we take two of the points in the five-pointed star, we can fill in all the space between the cells, which you remember are divisions of the original single cell from which you derive. Now, these cells, insofar as they haven't got direct nervous inhibiting forces on them, respond totally in a situation. Therefore, at the cellular level, there are no gaps of frequency. That means that if you can take yourself, by the suitable exercise, below the level of the nervous system rational control, you will expose yourself to frequencies which in fact will give you information that you cannot get to your five specialized sense organs. And this information will be more diffuse than the sense organs, but it will refer to other levels of being than the sense organs can in fact touch. So, after we've left the free spirit, gone into the first bondage and the logos and the necessary form, we descend into the contingent form, which is not necessary, which is governed by laws only statistical. That is, the laws which can change as the information grows. When we come down a further stage, we come into a realm where desire operates instead of idea, where the desire is an energy pushing us along, and it is pushing us towards the pleasant and away from the unpleasant. But it is nevertheless determined, although it is not determined in the sense in which the mechanical adding of sense data at the top are determined, it is still limited, and it has fewer factors to play with, and therefore its limitation is much greater on its action. The animal runs towards the pleasant and away from the unpleasant, and is therefore determined, we can say, in a double manner. We'll put a plus for liking and a minus for disliking into it. Now, when we come down onto the level of the vegetable reaction, we find again that this doubleness of the pleasure pain is there, but it cannot run about to get it. It can only get it by a slow process of growth. The roots will grow towards the damp. They don't get up and run towards the pool, they grow towards it. Nonetheless, it is a kind of orientation towards that which they need. When we come down to the mineral level, down here, we are coming down to the level of pure inertia. This line that marks the mineral world top level, we can call the line of demarcation between life and death. We'll find this is very, very important psychologically later. As soon as we get down to the level of the mineral, we have entered the world of death. Everything above the mineral level, doesn't matter whether we include viruses and bacteria or not at the moment, we'll keep it simple. Everything below this top line of the mineral order is dead, that is inert, that is unable to develop from inside itself. But everything above that line is growing, and that growing towards the object, simply and slowly like a plant, or growing inside itself, internal organs of discrimination, organs of specialized desire, which lead to mobility. Then to the growth of specialized sense organs in the five sense man, and then to the growth of the pure logos faculty in the cosmic minded man. At each level, as we go down, we are losing a freedom. And at the bottom level of the mineral, we have lost all the freedom. The thing is now not freedom at all, it is just dome, it is restraint. Now, what we want to do is make a diagram. Everybody can make his own in the privacy of his own chamber without telling lies. He doesn't need to show it to anybody else. Make such a diagram and then start off with all the subjects that you can think of. Supposing you take physics and science. Where will you put it on this diagram? Supposing for a moment you have no interest whatever in physics. You are quite apathetic. You don't see that it's of any use to you. Now, if you're apathetic, you are not feeling. Apathy means not feeling. Consequently, you must be on the level of this dividing line between the inorganic, the dead, and the living. If you don't think physics is important to you at all, you have no feeling whatever for it, you can put your physics line inside the mineral world. And you can say, in relation to physics, you are dead. This might not seem important until you come to consider this, that the dead get buried by the living. Whenever you don't know something, you are passive to another being who does know something about that subject. Remember our basic rule, either you learn to push yourself about, or you will be pushed about by another being. And there's no middle course in this world. The beings that will not learn to become self-determinant will be determined by other beings. So if there is a subject you don't know about at all, and you feel apathetic about, so that really you say, I can be dead to that thing, put it down below and mark yourself a bad mark, because in that field you are passive. If in another field you think you can work it out from first principles, you say one of you is soaked in Euclid or something, in relation to geometrical necessity you can put yourself a circle up here, if you can. Now, if your geometry is empirical and has been derived by fiddling about with a pair of compasses empirically, and no necessary propositions have arisen in you, then you will have to write it on the empirical level. But at the empirical level, you are subjected to the necessary laws of geometrical motion. Now, take any other subject at all that you like, whether it's art, science, anthropology, sociology, psychology, psychosomatology, whatever it is, place yourself a circle and write the name of that thing in the circle. And then have a look. You will discover that most of your circles are somewhere below the line of even the empirical man. You might get one or two of them just breaking the line out of the animals. If you can say that you have a desire to do something, and that that desire is actually making you study a little bit, you can place yourself in the animal level. If you've got a little bit of empirical information, you can draw your circle breaking the line. If you have a wish for a certain subject, certain information, but in fact you're waiting for it to come to you, you must put that one in the vegetable world. Now, for every conceivable subject, you must make a circle, and you must be quite truthful with yourself and place these circles on the diagram, and then you must look at them. They'll all be down at the bottom. And then you must remind yourself that unless you lift these circles up, you are passive to the other beings who've already lifted up theirs. This means in every field, wherever you don't know anything at all and couldn't care less about it, you are dead. And that's subject to four other levels, finited, and one level absolute. If you can lift the subject into the wishing without doing anything about it, at least you're slightly better than the dead mineral, because it doesn't wish. If you can lift the subject up to the level of desire, where you actually start running about in circles without reading anything, then it's gone slightly higher. If you accidentally run into the library and read a book, you're going to the empirical level in some measure. And if you can actually get yourself a basic principle book of necessary propositions, then you can put your circle in the top level. But for every circle you do not put in one of those levels, you can place yourself as non-existent. And as such, you will constitute a non-entity for all the other forces in the universal field that actually do know something about it. It's a very useful scale, because in relation to any given subject, you will actually find, when you feel in your body, a definite positive or negative about it. If you know nothing about a given subject, and you think for a moment that you don't need to, if you examine your feeling very carefully, you will find the feeling of not needing to is accompanied with an excuse, a reason why you don't need to. And this means that you're not really comfortable about not knowing about it. When a man doesn't know about a certain subject, he will present some kind of excuse. He hasn't had time, or he doesn't see the relevance of it. As soon as he sees the relevance, then his guilt will increase until he can climb up and get the information he needs. Now, if we say we will draw a line between the animal and the man, like the evolutionists tend to do. They let the man grow from the mineral, the vegetable, the animal world, and then they say there's a new emergent. This new emergent is in vocabulary and the human hand. Speech and the hand have made man what he is. Speech has enabled him to tabulate the universe of forms, and hand has enabled him to utilize those tabs to shift the world about. In fact, to draw the line absolutely between the animal and the man there raises a lot of problems, because we do find vocabularies in the animal world, and we find birds with vocabularies of perhaps 15 or 20 different whistles. We find monkeys with vocabularies, and so on. Their vocabularies are not as complex nor as well manipulated as those of an ordinary empirical man. Nevertheless, they have them, so it isn't an absolute difference. But as soon as we come to the level above the empirical, we can draw a really important line. Because as soon as we get above the empirical man into the level of necessary forms, we've come across something quite different. The mineral, the billiard ball, moves when we hit it with a cue. The plant world is already waiting for the opportunity to move. Its roots are just waiting for the damp and they'll start. Its branches are waiting for the light and they will start. So that when you get, after the cold winter, the seed lying dormant in the ground, and then the first rains come, and then the sun starts to warm it up, and you're moving towards the first point of radiance, and the absorption of moisture and heat are just what the plant needs when it starts to grow. It is waiting for it. When we climb into the animal level, it takes that energy, uproots itself, and runs about in search of its food and enjoyment. We look at the empirical man, and he only does the same thing. A billiard cue hits him on the sense organ. Light hits him in the eye, and he sees something. He can't see something unless he is hit in the eye by the stimulus. He can't hear something unless somebody strikes the bell outside. And therefore, he's no better in principle than the billiard ball. He's just more complicated. There are more billiard balls in the empirical man than there are on the billiard table, unless it's overcrowded. And as soon as we get to the top, where the man is aware of necessaries, he can do something that the empirical man cannot. He can hear bells that nobody rings. He can go in a quiet room on his own, and from first principles, he can argue, my physical body, my so-called material body, is energy in motion. The particles of my material body are simply energies rotating. They are rotating in a field which is absolute. And that absolute itself is a field of power, and all the constituent motions of all bodies are simply modifications of that field. Consequently, from first principle, we can say that if we take ourselves into a quiet room and know that our sense organs respond to stimuli, then all the parts of our organism must be stimulating all the other parts. So if we make ourselves very, very sensitive and be very, very quiet and listen very carefully, we will actually hear noises going on. If you lie down, relax yourself, and wait, you will hear sudden pings in the head and in little parts of the body. You will hear funny noises like bells ringing, or you will feel a remarkable jolt and a flash like electricity jump in some part of the body. And you discover that you don't need an external stimulus to do this. In the same way, if you lie in a perfectly dark room, start looking, put your consciousness in the retina at the back of the eye. After a few seconds of doing that, you become aware that the room is not dark. Really, what you have done in the act of concentrating on the retina is to stimulate it yourself. As you stimulate your own organism in this way, you give rise to phenomena inside yourself which are not dependent on external phenomena. You can stimulate those that have been derived from external phenomena and stored up in the memory, in the substance of your being, and by concentration, introversion, and direction of these energies, you can cause memories to replay and you can raise them to the level of hallucinations. You can relive events in that way, by internal self-stimulation. In the same way, by internal self-stimulation, you can discover the kind of information that the cells will give you sub-rationally. You can understand how the vegetable part of your own being, the digestive parts of your body, that absorb things like plants absorb from the earth, they have a peculiar consciousness of their own. And it's quite distinct, even though it belongs in this same body, to the level of the desire, the animal in you. There is something in you that just sits and let things come, like din-din down the tube. If it comes, you will digest it. But there's another level at which, as soon as the stimulus hits you, if it's of a certain order, you get up and chase it. If it's of another order, you get up and run away from it. Right? It is a different part of your being, and it corresponds with a different part of evolution. When the animal in you, the desire in you, gets up and runs about, then you find the other level where ideas are presented in your mind from empirical experience, from stimulation of your five sense organs. And then at the top level of the individuated being, you find this sphere of necessary logical propositions and then the laws of necessary motion. All these coexist inside the same being, and you can only get at them by fulfilling the conditions at which those things themselves must exist and which they must fulfill. This means that if you want to know about what happens at the necessary level, you must study the necessary laws of motion. If you don't know about them, you'll have to draw your circle about them elsewhere. If you know nothing about them, you'll have to place it right down below and say you are dead in relation to the laws of motion that are necessary. Let's consider a very simple one we've done before. Motion is either open motion or closed. There's open motion going along, and it never closes itself. So she's just a continuous travelling through space. But the closed motion goes round and wraps itself on the tail. Now, necessarily, the one that travels in a straight line and never closes anything can never bring anything to be. It cannot make anything. Make means close the substance. The making, the makeless maiden Mary, immaculate Mary, unspotted Mary, means the substance, the Mary, Mari, or cosmic ocean, which itself has no closes within it. If we consider the virgin substance, that is the substance of force, absolute, with no closes whatever, then we are considering the meaning of the symbol of the Immaculate Mary. The infinite ocean of power, considered without any rotating forces in it, and therefore without closed forces, is immaculate or unspotted. And that of itself, because the absolute power is sentient, must consist in a ceaseless travelling without arriving. It is a perpetual travelling without coming to a term. Term implies a closure. And when it says in the Bible that God so loved the world that he gave his son, it means that there was something peculiar about this absolute unclosed motion, which to this motion itself seemed unsatisfactory. Unsatisfactory means not being making. Unsatisfactory. Not being making. Being means closing. If we imagine this absolute ocean of infinite sentiency, it must feel itself eternally unsatisfied, because it is a going without arriving. It is a seeking without any finding. Now, if it is to become satisfied, it must turn. It must close itself. When it closes itself, it has done two things. It has found for itself an object, but it has restricted the amount of force involved in the closure. Now, this is the very beginning of dialectics. It's the very beginning of the statement that if you do a thing, you will simultaneously do the opposite. If you know that fact, you won't mind doing the opposite at the same time. And if you don't know it, you will find yourself locked up when all you wanted to do was play about. Every time you commit yourself into a situation, you are looking for some satisfaction. But if you don't analyze the necessary relations in that field, you will put your energy into it, looking for the satisfaction, and in the act of inwinding your energy into it, you will lock yourself up. So the person who wants to be important in politics must study certain things, and as he succeeds, so duties will be put upon him. Now, he may not go in for the duties, he may go in for the job and what it can give him, in perhaps in reputation or increased earning level. Whatever he goes into it for, he will find that he doesn't get that thing only, he gets the very opposite. He raises his level in order to become freer and to get more power. And in the act of raising his level, he finds he's less free and has less power. Because the higher he goes, the more responsibility he gets. Because responsibility is the ability to respond. So when he gets right to the top, he finds he's got absolute responsibility. And absolute responsibility means responsibility for absolutely everything that is. So if a man climbs to the very top level seeking absolute power, he discovers when he gets there that he is now in charge of the universe. And he will have to run it on the same kind of lines that he complained about when he was at a lower level. Now, not to see this in the first instance causes striving for higher power. But as soon as you see that the increase of knowledge increases responsibility, puts restraints upon you, as well as freeing you, because in freeing you from the level of the dead mineral, it puts you in restraint at the vegetable level, because you are now subjected to the pursuit of moisture and warmth. If you free yourself from that, you become an animal, and you run about, you find yourself restricted to the terrain where your dinner grows. If you free yourself from the animal and become an empirical man, you find yourself freed from those things and simultaneously bound to try to discover more about them. Because if you want to get your dinner where you want it, when you want it, you'll have to learn to dig in one country and transport the produce to another country. So the more you raise your level, the greater your responsibility and the more restricted you are. When you get up to the level of necessary concepts, you are very, very restricted indeed. And there's only one thing left for you to do there, and that is either strip yourself and go back to the mineral, or assume absolute responsibility. If you do so, then you find that you will do certain things freely, but they will not be the things that you thought you would have done when you were down at the level of the empirical man. The empirical man can't see very far. So he makes a big bang, and the big bang irradiates the atmosphere, and the radiations bite back at the empirical man. So he's forced by facts to reevaluate the situation, because he hadn't enough necessary thought in him to see the consequences of his act before he did it. And we place all the subjects we know somewhere on this graph, and know that when we do so, we are in fact passive to the absolute, if we've got a circle in the top level of the necessary logic, or to the absolute and the necessary if we're at the empirical level, or to the absolute, the necessary and the empirical if we're at the animal desire level, or to those four if we're at the vegetable level, or to those five if we're at the mineral level. So although raising the level increases responsibility, not raising it increases passivity and slavery to other beings on the way up. And the fact is that you cannot rely at all upon any of the beings here to do what you want them to do if they're above you, and as their level is frequently not that of the absolute, and therefore they haven't got absolute responsibility yet, they will not have a sense of responsibility towards you. And therefore, if you wish to escape the consequences of their erroneous and rash actions, you have no alternative but to try to raise your level right through the whole series. Now this is a dialectical process. Either or. Either you stay at the bottom and let everybody kick you about, or you climb up. As soon as you climb into the level of the plant, you can feel. Now you've got pleasure pains. When you climb into the animal level, you can have people depriving you of motion, of the pursuit of your desirables. When you rise into the empirical level, people might contradict your empirical results, write rude books about your conclusions, like you find in the field of empirical science. Historically, that all the discoverers of all the inventions are busy writing insulting books about each other and proving that not that man, but another man discovered this very thing. At every level there is warfare. Only the absolute runs through the lot and supports them all. Let's look at what happens psychologically. If we interpret this in terms of feeling, if you are at the absolute level, you feel free. But you also feel, in that fact, that it would be a good thing to create, because at that level you're spotless, you're immaculate, and you have no object. This is the objectlessness of the sage, the Taoist sage, who wills nothing at all. We know that Taoism in China, taken seriously, actually stopped them developing altogether. And it wasn't until an atom bomb dropped on a Japanese city that the East woke up to the fact that they had become passive because of this concept of the absolute disinterestedness in finance, of the absolute itself. The whole of Oriental religion climbed up to the absolute, identified with the absolute, and then sat down and let an ant colony be built round its ears. When the Europeans, who were at the empirical level, came and found the yogi surrounded by an anthill, they first took out their brownie number two and photographed him, and then they picked him up on a shovel and put him in a museum. He had become passive, in fact, to these other men, which means that in climbing up to his absolute, and then staying there, and yet leaving his mineral body accessible in the earth, he had been guilty of a little bit of bad logic. In terms of feeling, then, we have the absolute feels free and is free, but it feels inside itself a tendency to create forms. And this tendency, then, passes it down to produce the absolutely first finite being, the necessary logical being. Now, as soon as that's been put, the feeling of searching for something is fulfilled. You then feel quite happy with necessary truths, with necessary laws of motion. You don't seek people at all at the level of an ordinary man. You don't see a lover and his lass. You see a couple of packets of necessary motion. And you can see precisely what these packets of necessary motion are necessarily going to do in a minute. They'll get moved down by another necessary packet called a bobby. Now, as soon as they see these necessaries, they're regarding the whole thing at the level of motion, and they feel perfectly secure because the whole thing is absolutely necessary. There's no empirical search, there's no animal desire, there's no merely vegetative waiting, and there is no inertia. That there is a continuous penetration of the situation with necessary propositions of logic. Spinoza's philosophy is at this level, where he sees even God himself under the necessary laws of his own being. So, the absolute feels free, but feels that it would be a good idea to make something. As soon as it's made something, what it has made is necessary laws of motion. And at that level, the being feels that it's quite all right, God's in his heaven, all's right with the world, because all the motions in the world are necessary. And as soon as he identifies with the empirical man, he goes under the law of accident, because he doesn't know, then, what stimulus is going to appear at what time. He doesn't know whether he's going to be hit in the eye or the ear or the nose. one of his five senses or more will be stimulated and he will have no control over it. So at this moment his feeling changes. And the feeling, instead of being one of absolute security in the necessary laws of motion, becomes one of continuous insecurity. The empirical man is in perpetual terror, because he does not yet know enough. He doesn't know the necessary, therefore he has no security. So he runs about rapidly, piling up data in the attempt to get that security. The next stage of involvement is when we come down to the animal level. And then, instead of pursuing knowledge as such, like the empirical man, we feel in us the pursuit of the desirable and the avoidance of the undesirable. This is a totally different experience, quite valid at its own level. Now, we've lost the feeling of being free, we've lost the feeling of the necessary, we've lost the feeling of the pursuit of knowledge as such, and we're now merely pursuing the desirable. This is like the average man on Saturday night. Maybe he doesn't really want to think, he's pursuing something far better, and he lubricates himself with many pipes to get the engine working properly before he actually goes off on the chase. And when the next level is reached, this desire thing lapses from consciousness and you simply become aware that you are waiting for something to happen. You wish something would happen, you're not doing anything about it, but you sit there vegetating, as we say, waiting for the sun to shine or your boots to get wet so that you can grow yourself a root. This stage is a genuine experience inside. And the level below that is the level where you don't even wait. This state we find in certain mental cases of catatonic state, where the being just sits without moving at all, with no signs of sentiency, with no responses, quite anesthetic. You can stick a pin in him and he won't move. He's now like a mineral. All these states exist inside us. And as far as the empirical man is concerned, a stimulus from outside hitting him on one of the sense organs can knock him down into one of the other levels. It can't do this on the man who knows the necessary laws of motion, but it can do it on the empirical man. The empirical man is full of information, formal, and the information is caused by the knocking of the matter of his sense organs, producing feeling states and then desires which have attached to them formal records. So that if a man eats an orange, he gets a sense stimulus of satisfaction. The empirical man doesn't think it's necessary. Consequently, he tends to go down to the animal level and search for another orange. So every sense stimulus hitting the empirical man drives him about. So he's not really much better than the animal. The animal has a smaller vocabulary and therefore a more restricted response system to the empirical man, but he is still driven about. And we're concerned especially with empirical man at the moment, because we can say roughly that not many parts of the being of man today are really preoccupied with necessary knowledge. If you say that necessary knowledge would mean that all the things you are supposed to know about, you actually understand the necessary laws of motion that cover them. If you know something about mechanics, you must understand the necessary behavior of a lever, of shearing actions, of tensions, of stresses, of strains, and so on. If you know something about electronics, you must know the necessary motions of them before you can put your circle in that field, not the empirical, probable motions. So in any field at all that you care to mention, only if you know the necessary laws governing it can you really put your circle there. In psychology it would mean not that you think the soul is a feeling being, which it is, but that you actually know the necessary laws governing its feelings. You know that if it contracts in a certain way, it does so necessarily according to certain laws. And you know that these contractions will necessarily produce within it certain feelings. If you can actually say so, truthfully, then you're at that level. And if you can, of course, you've really not much more work to do. In fact, you've only got one work left to do. When you've got all your subjects raised up to the level of the necessary, all you have to do is throw them all away and enter into the absolute and become unspotted. Until that time, we're concerned with how to raise the empirical man to that level. Now, the empirical man has collected a lot of data, most of it erroneous. You can see that it's erroneous because most of modern science is still declared to be empirical. It does not act upon the necessary. Only a very, very few, a small number of higher mathematicians think in terms of the necessary. But everybody below that level is thinking in terms of the probable only. When we look at the laws of motion and we lift them up one stage higher, we can see why we like and why we dislike certain propositions. Remember that the absolute has produced a universe simply by involving itself, and it is passing out of itself as well. This is the diagram of Taurus in the zodiac, and it means the entrance and exit of the absolute force, just like the sign of Aries itself means the absolute force. We add this sign to a circle, sign of Aries to the sign of the circle, and it gives Taurus. When that energy comes in, the fact of it turning round creates necessarily a situation in which energy within it is bound and bound to rotate. So as soon as the energy coming in closes itself and goes round again, then the whole mass of force inside there rotates. Now a rotation of a motion which cannot stop cannot go to the dead center. This again is a necessary statement. So the motion which is coming in, spiraling in, closer and closer towards the center cannot reach it. It can drive in so far only, and then it has to come out again. Now this really is the secret grip of the whole universe. And we'll simplify it like this. We go in and in and in, and then we shoot out. Now that is the graph, the symbol of the polarity of the universe. There is an absolute force unclosed which is coming in, winding in towards the center which you can't reach, packs itself very tightly, and then shoots out. This is somebody winding in all the energy he's got and packing it so tightly that it must shoot. Now, the part of it that is winding in is female. The part that is shooting out is male. And there is no being that hasn't got energy winding in and shooting out. This means that every being is a hermaphrodite. And you'll find that all the great religions will tell you that the human being is a hermaphrodite. He's a male-female. Remember that the absolute power is sentient power. It comes in and feels itself coming in, winds round, feels itself to come into being, to being restricted, to pack itself in the center, to get hotter, hotter, tighter, tighter, more and more under the necessity of letting it out. It must let it out because the closure is necessarily finite. And at the moment of letting out, it is male. And this is going on continuously. Now, factually, in our body, we have the power, because we are not different from this absolute sentient power, we have the power of identifying with any part of the function. If we identify with the indrawing, the to me buffaloes, as they say in the old guys or scouts, the to me function, we are being female. If we can identify with the to you function, we are male. And this is the only difference. Now, as far as we are concerned empirically, we know of many cases of women turning into men. We know of no case authenticated of a man regressing into a woman. Now let's see why not. The force of the absolute comes in and starts to turn. So the state of woman is prior to the state of man. It cannot squirt out until it has been packed in. So the whole process of the impacting of the energy in the time process is prior to the shooting out. So it's the shooting out, the straight line, the feet out, and the, to me, the circle, are considered as temporal events, and the circle itself is seen temporarily to be prior to the straight line. But we see immediately that because the circle is derived from the straight line motion of the absolute prior to closure, that the absolute is absolutely male. As soon as we say that to me finitely means female, we have to say that the absolute translation power is male. This is why we say God the Father, not God the Mother. The absolute force travelling along is male, it is pushing to infinite space. When it turns, it becomes female, and it will carry on being female until it has packed into itself so much that it will shoot out again. Now, biologically, it happens to be a fact. It is a physiological fact that every man has been a woman. Every man has been a child, and a child in utero has actually been a female before it was a male. The male genitalia have actually been inside the body before they came out. This means that every man has been a woman. That before the force could shoot out, there was a time before it had shot out. And at that time, the stress was on the to me. That's quite easy to see why this should be so. The child inside the mother must say to me for a long time to get the energy to grow. If it says to me very quickly and gets very well fed and well informed and packs lots and lots of energy inside it, it will increase its heat and the necessity for discharge. This piling in of energy we call the movement towards tumescence. And after tumescence occurs ejaculation. But the ejaculation cannot occur unless the tumescence reaches its term. So the energy drawn in by the developing child in utero goes on to a certain level, and if he gets sufficient, or if it gets sufficient, it becomes a he. And if it doesn't get sufficient, it still has an appetite for more. Now imagine a being thrown into the world which has started the process and not completed it. That's a baby girl. Imagine a being that has started the process and has completed it, and this has become so strong in its consciousness that it has realized the virtue of aggression, of activity as opposed to passivity. As soon as the being has actually experienced the superiority of activity over passivity, it will never go back. We cannot conceive of a being abandoning power once gained unless it is constrained to abandon it by a superior force. So that as soon as a being has become stressed on this active side, the aggressive side of its nature, the male side, it will not abandon that unless we strike at it with tremendous forces from outside and knock it back and make it regress. We can never get it to abandon that completely, because it will always have a mnemic trace of the value of the activity. So we can't get a man to regress completely to the level of a woman. We can treat men with hormones of a certain kind, which will make them a bit softer than they were. They might develop secondary characteristics of the female, but we can't make them abandon completely the masculinity they have derived. So here is a female. And the fact that it hasn't reached the term of tumescence means it is still hungry. And it knows what it's hungry for. It's hungry for more energy so that it can pack in and shoot out and thus aggress or dictate the conditions of life outside. Now when it says in Genesis that the desire of the woman shall be to the man, it means quite simply that inside every woman there is a tendency, a desire, a movement towards increasing self-determination. Self-determination is that which occurs when the energy packed in shoots out and makes a universe of its own. And let's see what happens. If we take any centre of energy, which has come in at a certain frequency and condensed, that might be the sun in the solar system, The energy condenses, packs very tightly, becomes tumescent, reaches the limiting factor where more energy coming in, suddenly it explodes, shoots the energy out. The energy shoots out to a certain distance and then collapses on a new center. So all the energy shot out collapses on a new center. It's this kind of process that develops planets in the greater universe. That energy shot from centers of compression collapses onto new centers outside, so that the ejaculated energy of a sun falling at a certain distance onto a new gravity center has become self-determinant. That is, it is no longer dependent on the center from which it derived. It now proceeds to involve itself and generate a system from itself. And this is the ideal for all the beings there are in the whole of infinite space. That every being is pursuing absolute self-determinism. And this is not an immoral thing, because morality or immorality is irrelevant to it. It is a necessary motion of the absolute spirit. The absolute spirit is infinite. It is not in any sense frightened of the generation of finite centers, because they can never overthrow it. But it continuously moves into centers formed, piles them in with energy in order to shoot out fresh energies to fall onto gravity centers and make new beings. Every time it shoots onto a gravity center, it creates a new being, and the new being is unique. There are no two beings, not even identical twins, in the whole universe that are absolutely identical. This means that every being is peculiarly itself in its peculiar configuration, and therefore is absolutely justified, that is, justified by the absolute, in existing in and for its own development. And from the relations of all these unique beings, the whole process of universal evolution is enhanced and made more valuable. I think we return.
That circles on the level of being diagram, so we better redraw the diagram.
Now, the subject is agriculture here. Three people have considered their attitude towards it and want to know where to put their circles. The first one has had environmental circumstances of early life which resulted in contact with this subject and some empirical knowledge. There is feeling bias in favour, some grasp of its cyclic relatedness at the top level. And this last would seem more in feeling than in formulation. Now, already this is quite a complex series of ideas. We have something empirical from early life, and a feeling bias in favour. What's a feeling bias in favour? There's no statement here of the actual mobilization of the desire to drive towards the acquisition of further knowledge. There is some empirical knowledge, which means something in the memory, and a feeling bias towards it. But it isn't a formulation. So really, the circle belongs in the feeling bias plus a memory of some empirical experience. So it isn't an actual process of empirical research now. So we're going to have to vector that empirical memory structure into the present feeling circle. The next person has no empirical knowledge and no inclination towards gaining any. The subject is seen as a necessary manifestation in connection with man's feeling processes. Not much work has been done on top-level implications. Now, the important thing here is that there's no inclination. Now that's down here, the level of apathy. when the physical inertia and the feeling present is not sufficient to lift it up towards the level of desire, towards mobilizing it. It might be that there's an idea that it is somebody else's business. Whatever it is, in this particular case, we'll have to place the subject matter quite low down. The third person has had a short period of interest which provided some data. Those sound like empirical data, a short period of interest which provided some data, feeling strongly biased, so we can lift the feeling up here. It's almost breaking through into the desire because of association with nature in general. Some work has been done at the top level where the subject is seen in relation to a concept of the transforming of solar energy. That's up here. There's a certain amount of work that has been done. That, of course, is now stated here by has been done to be a memory function. And this is brought down and helps in the strong bias. So we see that these three people differ in their levels of being. The present level of being in the first and third is roughly equal at the feeling level, with a slight stronger bias and movement towards the desire and the calling in from the a priori conceptions and the relation between solar energy and earth life. I say this a priori here, although it might be shown that some empirical triggers have been provided to make this person believe that there is solar energy coming to the earth and that it can be used. You can see that if we do small circles for things we are not actively engaged in and tie them up with the big circles about our general level of being, that the diagram can be made fairly simple. Another good thing is to use the colours and their appropriate symbology to colour the circles so that you can see immediately what kind of relation there is between the different subjects. If you colour circles red, then they will be placed inside the diagram and yet they'll be related to desire and action. If you colour them blue, they'll be related to the intellect. Now, this diagram of levels of being might have started a few layers and it might have produced a feeling that there's too much work to be done. And it can appear that there's too much work to be done if we take the particularized subjects that you will find in any book about the sciences, plural, of man. You might find several hundred different subjects, each of which will take you several years to study. Consequently, if we are to move at all quickly, we have to have another method of approach to the same subject. Factually, if you try to take any given subject, like agriculture, before you know where you are in another totally different realm. You're forced immediately into astronomy by a study of agriculture because of the fact of summer and winter, and the fact that the incidence of the sun's rays and their angle on the earth triggers off this process of growth. So you find all the subjects that are apparently different are really mixtures of a few very simple subjects. And these subjects we can list under the general heading of power. Absolutely all is power, and this power is a sentient power. It feels itself and it keeps a good account of itself. This power formulates. It is a formulating power. Under that threefold heading, we can see all the possible subjects that can be considered to be grouped. Then we can consider that we will use a special version of the word power and its significance in the word force. A force here, as you can see, has F-O, while the other has P-O. Will this F and P are interchangeable, and force means a differentiating power. When we apply a force, it produces a change. To account for a change in the causative sense, we posit the application of a force. We have force, that upon which it is applied, which is matter, and we have time and space. And this becomes much simpler. All the other subjects that we are concerned with are simply peculiar mixings of these primary constituents. In every situation there is so much sentience, awareness, so much power, which ultimately is the concept of cause, so much formulation, which is circumscription. If your awareness increases, then the formulations become clearer and the power becomes more active. When you can adequately define force and matter and time and space, then the other subjects can be subsumed under these. There is so much sentience, so much power, so much formulation in analytical psychology. There isn't exactly the same amount of those in psychoanalysis. You know, Jung and Freud use these terms in opposition. Psychoanalysis is one term, and analytical psychology is another term. And it is stated at great length that analytical psychology is not psychoanalysis. There's more energy involved in analytical psychology than there is in psychoanalysis. We can say that in the Jungian mode of analytical psychology, we are forced to examine formulations of a much wider field and a much earlier formulation in time. Early traditions, myths, and so on. The collective unconscious, collective will, and an order of sentience that transcends the individual. Whereas in the Freudian psychoanalysis, you're concerned with an individual and attacking that individual with a series of stimuli in free association, and in so doing producing an individual response as opposed to a cosmic response. And there is less power in the Freudian concept than in the Jungian concept because of this. So if you study psychoanalysis, you can study what it is in much less space of time than you can study the Jungian analytical psychology and its roots in very early religious and mythological structures. When we consider force and matter, time and space, we can find out the key to a lot of other subjects. We know that matter, we put TM point, which we'll see in a moment, is simply a rotation of force. When the force is considered as applied, that is when we correctly use the term force, we're imagining a certain amount of power now vectored and arriving at a certain point of producing a change. The absolute power translates without turning and makes no thing. As soon as it turns and brings into existence a thing, then whatever power comes to it from outside and impinges upon it continually is called a force and produces a change. As soon as it produces that change, we then are forced to invoke the concept of space, because change is recognized by the appearance in a place in one moment and then in another place in the next moment. So that motion is from place to place and is measured through time. We find then that as soon as we put this TM in for the matter, we have invoked concepts of time and space. Now, if we say that the concentration of this force produces a primary particle, and that primary particle is simply condensed power, then in the act of condensing, it has produced round it a zone of rarefaction. This is what happens in the propagation of sound impulse. The rarefaction round about it is called space, and the condensation is called matter. There is no absolute difference between matter and space. There is only the difference of the concentration or condensation of force in a point or moment of matter and the corresponding rarefaction around it. So that space itself is a peculiar thing that cannot be conceived to exist without points of matter or condensations, which means simply that the concept of space is the concept of that which surrounds points of condensation. Now, we can easily see that men can push material objects around, like I'm pushing this piece of chalk around. But if there is no difference, essentially, between a point of condensation and a zone of rarefaction, then if we can push around a condensed force, matter, and there is no difference, essentially, between matter and space, we should be able to push space around too. And this is the basis of the mental continuum. We will draw it in another way now, we'll imagine a section to it in which points of condensation are represented like wave crests. Now, for every point of matter or condensation, there is a rarefied zone surrounding it. Now, so there is no difference essentially between these. If you can push the one about, you should be able to push the other about. But in order to push the other about, you must become sensitive to it. You can push the gross thing about only when you're concentrated on your gross body. If you concentrate, identify on your gross body in the so-called waking state, you can make your legs roll about and go about. And if you fall asleep, and in the process of sleeping, you pass through a dream level, at that moment your power over your gross physical body is abandoned. So although you have a gross physical body, you are not able to move it because you are not identified with the gross level. I will say that all these points of condensation constitute the waking phenomena of a man. But in between these are other states, and these states are less defined, and they go to a mediating point where the difference between point A and point B is abandoned. You move from point B towards point A, and you come to a point less and less B until it is no B. And you move from A, less and less and less A, until it is no A. And no A and no B meet. Now at this point, you are not determined at all by the form, but you are dealing with an energy, with force, with power. If you then identify with the space between these apparently discrete entities A and B, you reach the point of the paradox where you are identified with neither A nor B. Now at this point you will have no sharpened A-B consciousness, but you will have a definite awareness, which is paradoxical in its nature. And because it is neither A nor B, it is not conditioned by A or B, and therefore, in that place, in that trough, it is possible for you to insert another form. If you do, that space will then proceed to condense. Now this is the mechanics of materialization in the cells, and it is the basis behind telekinesis. To do it, you will have to become spatially conscious. You know that when you are awake in the gross material body, you depend on an external knock on your gross organism. When you go into a dream, you are dependent on something quite different, namely to the capacity of the blood to pick up subtler and less precisely defined states. That places you in the subtle world. It is still formal, but it isn't condensed. And in it, the mode of choice or motion there is conditioned by feeling, by liking and disliking, by love and hate, by hope and fear. So the sequences in the dream world are conditioned really by whether you like it or not. You either like it and hope to get it, or you dislike it and fear that it will come. And these two states of feeling produce all the variations of the dream imagery. Now, we've seen in this diagram really a linear structure, which is an abstraction out of the total sphericality of macrocosmos. At right angles to it, there is something else quite different from A and B, and neither A nor B, and this is not the subtle world, it is the causal world, which is power itself. If you go on the other side of the dream, you can come to a state of dreamless awareness. You have no gross object, you have no subtle object, you have an immediate awareness that you are power. This power is in no sense restricted by the concepts of A, B, that is, concepts of empirical bodies, nor by the subtle ones, the formulations derived as aftermotions from those in a given matter or body, but you have an immediate awareness that you are power. And in this level, you are not restricted by particularized points of matter, nor by particular formulations called dreams or fantasies. You have an immediate awareness that you are power, and there is no restriction on you whatever. And because this is obviously such a mightily disturbing potential in the universe, there are various little devices inside the human brain to cause you to be diverted as soon as you begin to approach it. We've had this before, and this is the fiery sword that keeps you out of the tree of life in case you should eat it and live forever. If an individual man climbs to that power and he hasn't previously prepared himself, the first thing he will try to do is produce evidence that he has attained it as an individual, and he will start interfering with the macrocosmic structures, because the only way he can conceive at that level of proving that he's got it is by using it. And he feels it necessary to prove that he's got it because he's only just got it and he's not sure that he's got it. And he would like to show other people that he has it so that they don't think he is powerless if they should get it. The whole thing is fear conditioned. And therefore, inside the brain, we'll just imagine for a moment this circle of the brain, and inside here is the immanent spirit. And that immanent spirit is the same as the sentient power, which is a formulating power, creative power. And round it there is a special high-speed zone. It's a wall of power which rotates very, very fast. Any empirically originating impulse coming inside here produces formulations in the action band. Those formulations are empirical. They go in, they can't penetrate into the immanent spirit. If they do penetrate that far up to the wall, they'll bounce off it and come out again in the form of a reflex action. The speed of this band is kept up because otherwise an empirical impulse could penetrate into the immanent spirit and would then condition it. And if it were conditioned, there could be no free center. So this center maintains its freedom by a very high speed rotation, which acts as a deflector, so that whatever angle an impulse comes in at, it is thrown out and becomes a reflex elsewhere. Now, if we imagine that there is another band inside, so that immediate sense impulses, like knee jerks, bounce in and out of a layer near the perimeter. This is something like radio waves bouncing on the various zones around the Earth or other planets. When the impulse comes in and bounces off, a certain kind of impulse will not penetrate the dream world here. you'll have a perimeter zone of what you call concrete facts, extent material experiences. If you manage to penetrate a little further inside, you'll come into the dream zone or zone of fantasy. If, when you approach nearer to center, you observe the formal change, you find that the nearer you go to center, the less particularized the form. The form is very particularized at the gross level by the actual fact of the stimulus hitting it being from a formalized source, like light hitting a square, producing a square stimulation on the retina. As soon as you go inside the realm of the dream or fantasy, which is fundamentally the same thing, it's a dream if you're asleep and it's a fantasy if you're awake, you are less particularized because the impulses are not so discrete and they begin to fuse with each other, so that you can have an ambiguous figure in a dream. You can see a figure with a black coat on looking very threatening, and it really represents you in a bad mood, shadowing you and about to get you into trouble. You can project all sorts of versions. You may appear several times in the same dream with different characters, simply because you have a variety of what we call social personalities within your action band. The nearer you penetrate to the middle, the more these images fuse together, until when you get to the level of the wall of the immanent spirit, it is extremely difficult to separate out your sentience and your power and your formulation. They have all fused together. Now, unless you know this to be so, you will discover that as you go in, by the mere fact of the loss of particularization, as the whole bias of your organism in the waking state is towards particular aims, you begin to lose interest. As the stimulus becomes less particularized, your interest drops, and by the time those fantastic images in solution merge together, your interest has been abandoned and you are then asleep. You're not in the immanent spirit. You are outside this special rotation band, and your inner zone, which is of no interest in. But that zone is actually full of all the forms that you would be interested in empirically if you could sort them out. The psychologist tries to penetrate into these images and to bring them up and make them conscious again to resolve certain empirical conflicts and their shadows or ideas in the mind. But practically all modern psychology, when it talks about depth psychology, doesn't go any deeper than this place where all the psychological elements, the ideas derived from empirical sources, fuse together. Even Jung is guilty of deriving his collective subconscious from experience in the time process. And therefore, although he's deeper than Freud, who is a materialist, nevertheless, he is in fact conditioned by the time process and by a theory of the experience of the human race adding up, and all the elements of human experiences fusing together at the depths of the psyche. So depth psychology, for a modern depth psychologist, doesn't mean going any deeper than the place where these things fuse together. It doesn't break into the zone of immanent spirit. It might be possible to say, in one sense, that if you go deeply enough, it will stop being psychology and start becoming pneumatology. It will become a science of spirit instead of a science of psyche, namely the immanent spirit. It will still be a science because immanent spirit knows and is the original scientist. It sees. Science is simply the verb to see and to formulate or shear or cut. And this immanent spirit in its creative activity sees what it is doing and proceeds to formulate and to cut and so on as it throws out from itself its creations. Nevertheless, that band is so rapid in its rotation that no ordinary force derived from an empirical impulse can break through it. Consequently, we have to devise a method of retaining interest as we introvert our attention. We have to discover that the external gross material world is a world of effects, not causes, and we have to accept that it is better for us to know causes than to be preoccupied with effects. As soon as we begin to prefer causes to effects and realize that all cause is internal, then we begin to see particulars only insofar as we can collapse them into other particulars. If we can see in all the individuals dressed in trousers and skirts about the place simply as human, we've already gone in a bit. We've telescoped a lot of particulars together, and we start dealing with a human being. We define that human being in a certain way, and we insist upon dealing with the beings outside as if they were human, even though they have a large variety of differentiating factors. Now, if we push them further in still, instead of calling them merely human in the terrestrial sense, we can say that they must necessarily be modalities of the original absolute sensing power formulator. This is the same thing as the Christian Trinity. That the human being is only a specialized modality of cosmic sentient power formulator. We then deal with all beings at the same level. Now again, so that every being that we encounter, right at the door, it is so much formulated power and so much sentience. It has less sentience than another being that would respond more quickly and that would respond more adequately. I can get a knife and proceed to cut the paper up. It cannot stop me doing it. A more highly organized being might see me go to it with a knife and dodge me. That's more sentience in it. So that whatever we see, we can actually make an equation if we wish and say so many elements are sentient, so many of power, so much formulation, and that will give us the key to any given science. You notice if we take a science like geometry, we are concerned with formulation. In studying geometry, generally, we do not consider the power involved in turning the compass about. We consider simply the fact of the relations of the drawn circles and triangles upon a surface. So that we're concerned with formulations and ratios, without power or sentience. If we try to consider Plato's ideas as mere formulations, we shall miss the whole point of Plato's meaning, because he knew that those formulations were formulatings, a continuous process of a verb, the verbum fiat, the let there be word of God. So to Plato, formulations or ideas were also powers, and ultimately sentient powers. So to reduce the thing down and say Plato's theory of ideas is to be understood as static forms in eternity which don't do anything is a mistake. They are powers formulating. And other people pursuing the same thing realize that if you're to be non-dualistic about it, you will have to say that wherever there is a formulation, a power is there formulating and has a definite amount of sentience involved in the formulation. You can then make an equation that every entity whatever and every subject whatever can be expressed in sentience to the nth, power to the nth, formulation to the nth. That way you begin to reduce this multitude of subjects down to a very simple proposition. You can divide your subjects immediately into those concerned primarily with sentience. Those are the ones in the biological field. Psychology is one of them. Those concerned with power, the dynamics of the universe, where you, for purely arbitrary reasons, ignore sentience and even ignore formulations. And those that are concerned with formulation, that is, with geometrical relations, where you ignore the facts of power and sentience for the time being. But if you ignore two of the Trinity, you are being very abstract and your science will suffer by being non-applicable in a real concrete situation. We take Pythagoras formulating something. Having formulated it, he thought that he should be able to do something with it. He then proceeded to behave in a certain way and tried to impose certain concepts in a social structure. And he and his followers are very, very quickly disillusioned about the value of that form as they saw it. They had seen, like the Greek mind saw, formulation as more valuable than sentiency and power. And consequently, they were stressing the form and thinking that if you present a form which is true, which meant geometrically self-consistent, that people would automatically want to use it, which was ignoring the mass inertia of the force involved in them, and ignoring the sentient aspect of them, the liking and disliking inertias. Consequently, he got chased out. Now, many of the Greeks thought that if they discovered a geometrical proposition that was self-consistent, and therefore true by definition at the formal level, that intelligent men wouldn't necessarily agree with them. And then they committed another error, that intelligent men agreeing with them wouldn't necessarily act in the same way that they did. And this produced a lot of persecution. One man discovers that the sun is bigger than Greece, and there's a big hot stone in the sky, says so, and gets chased out of the city. He's quite sure that he's right. Nevertheless, he gets chased out. Why? Because he doesn't take any notice of power at its political level. And he doesn't take any notice of sentiency at the level of the people. They don't want a big hot stone bigger than Greece in the sky. They want Apollo, a beautiful sun god, tearing about in a chariot. It's much nicer at the sentience level. Let's do our map again. We'll put P for power in there, S for sentience in there, and F for formulation in there. Now, any entity whatever can be analysed in this threefold manner. And the human being is going to do the analysis, and therefore he must be aware of what he means by formulation, by sentiency, and by power. He has a definite amount of something in him that pushes him about, and it pushes him about whether he formulates that it should or it should not. If he puts a certain substance, we call a mess of pottage, into his tummy, it will go down here, and because of a certain pulse affinity with the lower centre, will cause the whole body to dash off rapidly in a certain direction. And while he's being carried in that direction by those energies, like Esau was, he might have inside himself the recitation of the Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam going on, which is a rationalisation of the impulse. But he might have another word from Mother, that when you are taken away to join the army, you must remember to come back clean. And consequently, although he's being carried away, he'll be worried by this thought, by this formulation. Until he understands the nature of all the formulations here, they will not stop this urge. And until he's able to feel adequately the proper relation between power and form, he will not be able to control. And the power is pressing up, and the ideas are pressing down. And where these two meet, it's the Turbar, the turning zone of sentiency. Sentiency means to feel, but it also means, in a special way, to evaluate. A definite amount of power is brought up, a definite form is brought down. Good taste in art, in music, in painting, is simply this, that when the form presented has exactly the right amount of force in it, and no more, then that is in good taste. The taster is feeling. This is why the pseudo-science of aesthetics is the science of feeling. Aesthetics is the science of feeling. And it is only by feeling whether you've got the right amount of power in the given form that you can balance these two. If you compare a good film with a bad one. For instance, there's a film called Psycho made by Hitchcock. I don't know if anyone's seen it, but in it there are certain elements that have been said to be in bad taste. Now, bad taste in a serious film can be funny in a funny film, providing you say first, this is a funny film. As Chaplin in Monsieur Verdoux, the film opens and he is standing there with an incinerator smoking away, in which he is burning a wife, and he's snipping roses and smelling them. Now, as a serious statement, people would say it's in bad taste. But providing you know it's a comedy, it isn't in bad taste. So if you get the audience in the right mood, they won't think you're talking in bad taste if you tell a funny story about incinerating a lady. Whereas on another occasion, when a lady has just been incinerated and you tell her lover, you won't think it's funny if you say, did you notice the way her hair curled just before she gave up the ghost? This is tremendously important. We have a definite amount of power and a definite amount of form, and it has to be felt into perfect balance. If we don't feel it into perfect balance, the act cannot be perfect. If you're playing the violin, you put your finger in a certain position. It has to be exactly where it should be on the fingerboard. If it's a bit too far back towards the neck, it'll be flat. If it's a bit too towards the ridge, it'll be sharp. You have to know exactly where it is. And that is a matter on the fingerboard of placing your finger exactly in a certain position. And that is fundamentally a geometrical fact, and therefore a question of form. Also, you have to put your bow at right angles to the strings, because if you put it at another angle, it will skid sideways and whistle. And this fact of putting your bow on is again form. When the bow is on, you have to let the bow ride in a certain way. If you put pressure on the bow, the pressure on the bow might cause the rosin hairs of the bow to grip, and that grip may produce a very horrid noise. So you see, the amount of power you put on the bow must be exactly the right amount. The weight of the bow is seriously enough if it's a well-balanced bow. That's a matter of economy. If they made the bow too light, you'd have to press and then you'd get tired. If they made it too heavy, you'd have to push and you'd get tired. So the bow is made, if it is a good one, so that its own weight is sufficient when resting on the string to give you the tone you want, and that's economy. You have a definite amount of force to apply and a definite form to put into that force. If you put your finger on the string too lightly, when you bow, the vibrations of the string will slip under your finger. The result will be an impure tone. If you put it too heavily on, except in practice when you're going through a thing for the first time, you will slow down your performance, because there's a definite amount of energy goes into pressing on the string, and it takes time to apply that energy. So if you press too hard, you will slow yourself down. So you can see in a simple illustration like this that we have form to consider and energy to consider, and the two must be kept in perfect balance, and if they are, this is good taste. But the only thing that can balance them cannot be the form, and it cannot be the power. So it must be the feeling, which is able to get hold of the feeling level of form and the feeling level of power. Now this is only possible because the feeling is field awareness. Feeling is field awareness. There's your feeling. And this field itself is the effective cause of the condensations which become form. And it is also the cause and the vigor with which you make your condensations. So when you make an attack, either on a string instrument with a bow or on the voice, when you attack, the mode of attack is going to determine the psychological way it will be received by hearer. Because in the act of receiving it, the substance of the listener will reproduce the mode of attack on the instrument, and the listener, if he's identified with it, will undergo the same kind of threefold experience. you will be subjected to a definite amount of energy, a definite amount of form, and the balance of the energy and the form together will produce a correspondent feeling in the listener to the feeling of the person who actually bounds that power and that form. So in any art whatever, you will find that this power, sentiency, formulation thing has to be balanced, and it is balanced by means of the feeling. So it is only feeling and nothing else that can resolve the absolute opposition between force and matter and the primary urge and the idea. There is no other method, and it is caused by the fact that feeling is field awareness. When we then come to consider our divisions of levels of being again, the bottom one here, we can say the power has so involved itself in formulation, and the formulation is little rotations, that it's had no power left over for relating. The power has completely involved itself and is now completely materialized. That is the zone of death, where the power, in the act of rotating, closes itself completely. So that two such powers, completely closed in on themselves, have no relation with each other. In psychological states, this sensation of complete isolation produces the most painful of all psychological sufferings, a kind of death in life, where the person actually feels completely out of relation with all other beings. And it consists in identifying with a given concept that one is separate from other beings. Immediately above this level, I think I better start by blackening a little bit in the middle here. This dark circle represents the zone of complete involvement of power in rotation, which is matter. Round it, we have another zone of feeling, and where this field touches the zone of complete involvement, the feeling is apathetic, which simply means that it is not a feeling, it is identified with non-feeling, it is identified with simple existence sitting there, and it has no initiative whatever. But there is another zone round it, which is escaping away from the zone of identity of power form, which is matter, and produces desire. As we go away from this center, the gravitational pull, if you like the formulation, of the precipitated matter is weakening, so that then there is desire rushing away from it. And when we go out further, we find that the desire is falling onto centers and making ideas. Get some of those on my screen. The throwing out of desire, which is finite energy, and its falling onto its own gravity center, turns desire into idea. If there's further energy, it will fall out so far that instead of falling on separate centers, it will fall into a band, like the band around Saturn, which is the reason why Saturn is a planet symbolizing wisdom. It's reached the binding factor where instead of breaking into discrete entities or discrete attendant planets, it has maintained a ring. So then we have these levels of being as successive fields round the body. The more we concentrate on the physical body, the more empirically determined we are, the more we are acted upon by a contingent impulse from another such being. If we can just begin to feel, that is to have sympathy with some other entity, we are no longer conditioned by the merely continued stimulus of the gross material body. People with green fingers really have sympathy with plants. When they are putting them in the ground or pruning them, they don't just rationally follow the TV expert's advice of where to clip. They look at the thing, they feel it, and they let the snippers wander about a bit until they feel snip. When they do this, the plant responds because they have done what the plant felt it needed. And all green finger gardeners are simply beings who are identified with the plant and can therefore feel what it would like doing. Which is very similar to Hitler leading the Germans by feeling what they would like to do. And you remember he did it by soaking himself in mythology. And you'll find that really green finger people have a very good mythological sense of plants, and many of them probably swallowed Culpepper and various other similar works in their attempt to increase sympathy. Now, when you identify with the desire in another person, you will find yourself mobilized in the same way. As soon as you identify with any level of being, that level of being begins to operate in you. So if somebody's in a state of desire, and you tune in and say, I will contact the desire plane of this being, unless you have a great deal of control over yourself, you will find that their desire will begin to move you. And there's a tremendous amount of seduction leading astray goes on in this way, where a person in a certain desired state is sending out waves hoping that some person will identify with these waves. The person who does identify immediately responds, moves on a gradient along the desired waves, and comes to the being that wants to fulfill precisely that activity. And the next level is where you are empirically interested, and that simply draws you into contact with other people empirically interested. So that all the scientists and other people interested in empirical research tend to gather together in certain centres. And the next one is where you come to the level of a priori considerations. Now, you can see that because the material world is made up of a tremendous number of tiny particles, and these particles, when formed into groups, constitute fewer entities, group entities. And the bigger the groups, the fewer there are of them. It follows that there are more opportunities for gross material contact than there are for a feeling sympathy relation. There are more opportunities for a feeling relation than there are for a mobilized desire relation. There are more opportunities for an empirical discussion thing than there are for an a priori relation. Which means that if you want to find a metaphysical discussion, you will have to go further afield than you would do for an immediate contingent relation in the shape of a black eye on Saturday night in the appropriate pub. You can see then the real meaning of the higher they go, the fewer, and why any number of people concerned with these higher propositions will necessarily find it more and more difficult to find precisely what they want. If they go over the level of a priori rationalizing, they will actually find nobody to relate to at all, because they won't want to relate to a body. And they will find a zone of non-difference. In that non-difference, they will have contacted that original power which runs through the whole lot. So they could actually feel at home in a pub in the middle of an Irish fight if they wished. And it wouldn't bother them, because they would know that that is just as much a legitimate manifestation of absolute power as a metaphysical speculation is by one of the great philosophers. But until you get to that level, you are certain to believe that you should improve yourself if you have enough energy, which means gain power, gain increased sentiency, and gain formulation. Or if you feel you've got insufficient energy, you must turn back and become apathetic and then die. But it's either or. At any given moment throughout the day, you are either moving towards increase of power, sentiency, formulation, or something has hit you from outside and you're starting to fall back towards death. Every time you feel the slightest bit discouraged, you are really moving towards death. Somebody's hit you in the power, or in the sentency, or in the formulator. If anybody comes to you and your favorite idea is proved wrong, at that moment you experience a little death. Because if it's true that that idea is wrong, that idea is ready for death, and it will die. If you are identified with it, you will die with it. This is why William Blake said, born such a day, died 100 times since. Every time you identify with anything whatever, if it is proved false, you will die with it. Somebody may pride himself on his sentiency, on perhaps on his aesthetic sense. You may say he has good taste. You ask him to explain it, he can't give you a reason for it, and he's certainly not got any power to prove it, but he just feels that it is so. And if you then produce a proof that his position is entirely individual and subjective, and therefore fallacious, you have deprived him of the only thing that was keeping him alive, and he takes a dive down. If a man is very fond of his primary urge, and you show him that this cannot possibly work, that it cannot get where it is trying to go, then you will cause him to be very, very upset. And because you are dealing with the primary urge, it will get very, very overheated, and it might hit you for saying so. If it doesn't, it will rush off and get drunk to get rid of the criticisms you've just made. So when we're climbing up the level of being, instead of doing all those separate subjects, which of course are a very, very good method of teaching humility because there are so many of them, instead of that, you can do a simplified version of this. Place the categories that we've mentioned before, this power, sentiency, formulation, on here, on the level of being diagram, according to how much you know about them, and how much you feel about them, and how much you desire for them. So you can take the concept of absolute power. Would you like it? Or do you think you've got it? Or don't you care about it? If you don't care about absolute power, you can put it down here, you see, and be aesthetic about it. If you're a super nihilist, you can place your absolute power down there. Say it has gone to bed in matter. If you're perfectly honest with yourself, you will be surprised where you will put these circles when you come to consider them. If you're not careful, the gentlemen, they'll all tend to go in the top row. But you have to be very truthful about it and state to yourself how much empirically you know as well as a priori. How much genuine desire, that is mobilized feeling there is, and how much merely passive recipient feeling there is. And then, by considering the different sciences, as we've considered, say, geometry and dynamics and so on, and decide how much power, sentience and feeling there is in each of the scientists' fields, then you can begin to understand how to tackle any one of those apparently very diverse problems. I think we've overrun our time now.